The opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit KUCI.org. You're listening to In the Garden on 88.9 FM KUCI Irvine. I'm your host, Bill Brooks, University of California Master Gardener. A public garden is an institution that maintains collections of plants for the purposes of public education and enjoyment. In addition to research, conservation, and higher learning, according to the American Public Gardening Association. We're starting a series here, and I'm working with also Master Gardener Chris Bonner. Chris is a Master Gardener of Orange County, and he's visited a lot of these gardens several times. So what better person to bring us information on these gardens that we can apply right here in Orange County? So tell us more about some of the spectacular gardens in our world, and we're going to focus today on the Kew Garden in England. So Chris, first of all, tell us a little more about yourself.
Good morning, Bill. Thanks for having me. I was born and raised in California, San Francisco, north of San Francisco, UC Davis, UC Berkeley, Natural Resources. Minor in soils. I'm a dirt guy. I love that. I worked for the Forest Service. I did mapping for about 15 years, Thomas Brothers Maps and GIS mapping. And now I'm a retired environmental consultant. I've been retired since 2016, which is when I became a master gardener. And started a Master Gardener speaking series at the Murray Senior Center in Mission Viejo. And that's a monthly garden talk. We now average about 100 people per month, and we go through a variety of different gardening talks for Master Gardeners. I tell people that even though I'm retired, I still work. I just don't get paid for it anymore. And I just love to volunteer. I love volunteering with the Master Gardeners to inform and educate the public. I also do career coaching with my church. And I just started a gig. I'm an information guide at the Huntington Library, Art Museums, and Botanical Gardens. So I do love botanical gardens, and this is just really a pleasure to be here and talk about them today.
Boy, we are in for a treat this morning. That's going to be fantastic. You've had several speaking engagements and educational talks about garden tourism. Tell us about garden tourism.
Well, I got into this, so I had been visiting botanical gardens when I travel all the time. I love to travel. I love plants. I guess I'm a plantaholic, right? So I just love plants no matter where they are and how they are. And so I had this idea of doing a mashup between travel and visiting gardens in the world, but I wasn't really certain if there was an audience for that. I really didn't have a clue. I knew people like gardening classes and people like travel classes, but when you put the two together, what would happen? Well, about 2 years ago, I was doing a trip to England, and we visited Kew Royal Botanic Gardens, and the tour guide, when I told him this idea, he said, "Oh, Monty Don," and I said, "Monty who?" And he said, "Monty Don, he's the guru on BBC for the last 30 years doing gardening programs of how to garden and gardening in England and gardens all over the world, Japan, Spain, Italy, everywhere you can imagine." So on the way back, we stopped at Harrods and I got a copy of this book, Monty Don's Around the World in 80 Gardens. And that's kind of my travel guide now. So every time we travel, I research and find out what are some cool gardens to go visit. And I do that. So when I got back from that trip, though, I discovered there is this thing called garden tourism, and I had no idea, but it turns out more people visit gardens in the United States every year than visit Disneyland and Disney World combined.
Wow, I didn't know that.
More people visit gardens than Las Vegas.
Wow.
Those are all these millions of people going to one place, and gardens, the reason there's so many visitors to gardens in the United States is there's, you know, so many gardeners and there's so many gardens spread out in all 50 states. And so there's a huge demand. So I've been doing these talks for over a year now, and I draw some of the same crowd, but I get different people too. So it really is exciting for me to come and present these talks.
Yeah, and that's great. And I know gardening in the United States, I believe it's the number one hobby. Don't quote me on that, but I think I'm pretty close. Yeah. So tell us what the difference is between a botanical garden, an arboretum, a conservatory, or just a plain garden.
Okay, so a botanical garden It is a garden with a documented collection of plants for the purpose of scientific research, conservation, display, and education. So typically, the plants are well labeled with botanical names. They may contain specialized plant collections that are endemic to the part of the world where they're located. And so it's there's a big science aspect to botanical gardens, a lot of which is kind of behind the curtain, behind the scenes. It's not open to the public. The public-facing part is are these beautiful plant collections, these beautiful gardens. Arboretums are specialized in trees and woody plants and shrubs in their natural setting. And so it's not unusual for a large botanical garden to have an arboretum. Hugh has an arboretum. Or it can be a standalone. So LA County Arboretum in Arcadia started as an arboretum and still is an arboretum. That's really its focus. A conservatory usually refers to a greenhouse of a substantial size. And in San Francisco, there's this thing called the San Francisco Conservatory of Flowers. And I had a buddy, John, and every time we drove by, he always said, "That's God's house," right? And it's just, it's a very cool-looking structure, the architecture, but then the fact that it focuses on floristics, on flowering plants, it just knocks your eyes out. Just a plain garden, or even let's just take a park. So a park, right, it's landscaped. The plant palette's usually a lot more narrow. It's geared towards maintenance, and it's geared towards hands-on use, and so turf areas, sports fields, and the like. And just a plain garden would just be, you know, you could, a lot of these botanical gardens or fabulous gardens we have here in Southern California started off as estates. In fact, that was true with the Huntington as well. So, you know, an estate is just, it's, the difference there is it's usually not open to the public. There's some notable exceptions to those, but generally it's not public and there's no science.
And as we do this series, one of these days we will visit the Huntington and you'll get an idea of that. And that's right here in Southern California, which is nice. So you recently visited the Kew Gardens in London, England. And why did you choose to visit there? What initially drew you to that?
Well, we had a big trip planned and this thing called the pandemic came along and the cruise got canceled and everything went on and I lived in my pajamas for a year or two. And after 2 years or so and multiple vaccinations, we finally decided we were ready to make a trip. And so we had these air credits and we wanted to go someplace just 2 weeks to give to try our travel legs out here because we were still a little uncertain about being out with people in crowds. And I'd never been to the UK. We decided really just to focus on England. And so we just planned a 3 week trip going first to Bath where we could visit Stonehenge and Highclere Castle where Downton Abbey was filmed and then to Oxford so we could do visit the Botanical Garden in Oxford and the universities and also to go to Stratford-upon-Avon to get the whole Shakespeare experience and then spend 10 days in London and just had a blast. We did all the tourist stuff, Windsor Castle and Big Ben and Churchill War Room, the underground war room is just a fantastic, it's like a time capsule when World War II ended. They left everything, including the maps and the charts and the phones and the furniture in place. We went to the new Old Globe Theater. And the highlight for me was a private tour of Kew Royal Botanical Gardens. So it was, we didn't go to go visit a botanical gardens. I don't think I would ever do that. But absolutely, it brings me a lot of joy and enrichment to build in, especially when there's a world-class garden like Kew Royal Botanical Gardens.
What's the plant enthusiast's draw to Kew? Is there anything particular, especially if we relate it to some things that might work here in Orange County?
Well, it's interesting because there are no two botanical gardens that are the same, but they're kind of the elements, I think, that that appeal to me and I think appeal to a lot of people, gardeners and non-gardeners alike, is, first of all, there are usually beautiful landscapes, plants, flowers, with usually exquisite landscape design. And so they're well landscaped, usually they're well maintained. Almost all of these has an army of volunteers to help with the maintenance because, again, with plants, to make everything look their peak perfect selves, they need loving, right? And volunteer gardeners, you know, at these different gardens. So it's just the beauty of the landscapes and the plants. There's always an aspect of architecture and history. And so interesting buildings, and again, not just pretty buildings, but buildings with a story and a history behind them. I have a science background, and so the science plays into it. I'm not an artist, but I have a sensibility of an artist, and so I really do enjoy art. And that's another aspect you see in almost all the botanical gardens is they have woven in both permanent and rotating art displays and programs to in the tapestry of the landscape and the plants. And finally, I think the thing that I bring back from Kew and other gardens like this is just the diversity of plants, and that they're all open 12 months a year, and so they can't rely on just the roses or just the ranunculus or just whatever. They have to make the gardens look appealing and interesting year-round. And so this idea of plant diversity and using not just the flowers, but the foliage, the bark, and everything else to bring colors in 12 months a year. So diversity of plants and collections that just brings in something of interest every single month.
Yeah, and you talked about art in the garden, and there's also, too, the beauty when you visit these gardens worldwide is just the way the plants are laid out in themselves as an art form. The colors that are used in the different flower gardens also inspires and gives ideas that you can bring right back here to your garden in Orange County. You being a scientist, one of the things that happens at many gardens worldwide are scientific research, which is compatible and goes right in hand with our agricultural natural resources research. So tell us about the focus of research at the Kew.
Well, before we get to the research part, which is really 1945 to present, just kind of build up to, you know, how did Kew get there and how did it lead into, and there's been different kind of different versions of Kew. And so originally Kew was built in 1759 by King George III. So this is crazy King George, American Revolution, Hamilton fame, right? And the guy literally was crazy. He really was crazy. But he started the Queen's Garden with Kew Royal Palace. And so it was closed just to royalty to begin with. And then in the 1840s to 1880s, Great Britain saw the value. So today it's tech titans, but then it was finding economic botany, they called it. And so discovering plants from around the world that could bring additional wealth to Great Britain. And so spices, coffee, tea, palm oil, rubber, opium. They introduced opium as an economic crop. We don't like to talk about that chapter in Kew so much, but and then it kind of went into Imperial Kew, which it became a display of the might of Great Britain and the kind of the ego and the id of Great Britain. And so home gardens started to happen here. So there was wealth and so subdivisions happened and people had gardens for the first time. This is where the lawnmower was invented. This is where the garden hose was invented.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And
wow.
So it kind of went through that of displaying the might of Great Britain and all these exotic plants they would bring back from plant hunting trips from around the world to put into these great glass houses, these great greenhouses. But starting in World War II and present, it really focused on science and conservation. And this is really where Kew really does stand out. The Kew has over 400 staff scientists, which is unheard of. So it's really more closer to a university or college, let's say, in terms of what it has. It has a herbarium with over 7 million specimens.
Wow.
It has a fungarium, which I never even heard about, with specimens from every part of the world. It houses the Millennium Seed Bank with 2.4 billion seeds. And so we talk about climate change and think about how the world's changing and extinctions of plants. This is a long-term repository of plant material, of seeds for the future, should we not take care of here.
Should we need it? And as science allows, the DNA can maybe be used from these seeds to maybe make cultivars that work in a warmer climate.
Yeah, so they've got seeds for over 40,000 species and 97,000 separate seed collections. And finally, they've got a botanic library, archives, plant illustrations, DNA and tissue banks, microscopic slide collections, anything and everything. I mean, it's mind-boggling the research and conservation that Kew supports and is still able to support. And again, it was founded in the might of Great Britain, and economically they're not what they used to be. The country has changed quite a bit, but have found ways with endowments and partnerships to be able to continue this important mission of research and conservation.
And it sounds like in the States here, we have, every state has an agriculture and natural resource department, and it sounds like in Great Britain that this is where their primary agriculture and natural resource goes on, is at the Kew, and that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Now, conservation is a second function of a garden, and so highlight some of the plants that are being protected. I think you already did at the Kew in your last, but if there's anything you want to point out that's additional?
It's hard to summarize Kew because it's got so much, but there are 20 different major plant collections. They've got an alpine and rock garden collection, aquatic plants, arboretum, an arid collection, including succulents and cacti, and aroid, and I'll talk more about that in a minute, bonsai, bromeliads, carnivorous plants. They've got a huge collection of carnivorous plants, a huge collection of cycads, ferns, grasses, and then kind of the specialties, island floral, Mediterranean orchids, palms, temperate herbaceous, tender temperate, tropical herbaceous, all these subcategories. I'd never even heard of these before. And again, they don't have the climate for this, but these great glass houses where really they're able to do it. And it starts off with the alpine and rock garden collection. They have this this greenhouse, this glass house. It's the smallest and it's the newest one. It's really very cool looking, but it was kind of a thrill for me when we got there, because it's the rock garden. They build up kind of these rock mounds and then interplant with plants. So think alpine species that live on thin soil and temperature extremes. And amidst all this, when I was there, was this huge flowering of California poppies, which is exotic to them, but not so much for us, right? And seeing kind of an old friend in a new setting, right, where they not only have embraced it, but it obviously flourishes in London. And who would have thought California poppies would be so easily grown there?
And of course, they can control the environments and the plants work. Anything more to add about rare plants at all?
I'll get to that. I think the Princess of Wales Conservatory, so this is lots of tropical plants, lots of hanging plants, so these massive plant displays, you know, so think staghorn fern plantings that are suspended from the ceiling of a glass house that might be, you know, 10 feet in diameter. Just orchids, all sorts of things happening. They've got one collection that was interesting. So they have a succulent and cacti collection that, interestingly enough, ties back to the 1929 Chelsea Flower Show.
Wow.
And so this woman, Minerva Hoyt, she did an installation, an entry at the Chelsea Flower Show to publicize the California desert, because she was concerned it might be destroyed. And so it was the most popular thing, and presidents and kings from around the world, including the U.S. president, came to visit it. And this was responsible for the creation of Joshua Tree National Monument.
Oh, that is fascinating.
And it got transferred. It's the only Chelsea exhibit that was literally transported in whole and installed at the Kew Royal Botanic Garden, where it's still there. So it's, again, for us, and we've got some fabulous succulent and desert collections here in Southern California, it's certainly botanically doesn't outstripe anything that we do here in Southern California, but it's cool because this was kind of the beginning of Joshua Tree, and so that's just kind of a
The Joshua Tree England connection. That's fascinating.
Yeah. The it's also got this water lily house that was built in 1852, and it was named after this giant water lily from the Amazon, 10-foot diameter. They're grown as annuals every year, and there's pictures in the 1800s of small children sitting on the lily pads, and that's kind of a fun thing to see. The centerpiece is probably the Palm House, and again, when our guide said, you want to go see the Palm House? And I said, well, you know, my brother was a palm tree grower. It's not necessarily my favorite plant type. And he goes, oh, but it's not really just palms. It's really tropicals. And so, and they do these fabulous plantings around it. They got the oldest potted palm tree in the world. It was planted in 1880, and it's still alive. And it's just this...
Well, that qualifies for a rare plant, for sure.
Yeah, so hanging lobster claws and beehive ginger and Java glory blower and just these, you know, otherworldly types of plants. The other great glass house is the Tempered House, which dates back to 1863. And as the name implies, so this is semi-tropical, temperate. And the cool thing is it's... Architecturally, these buildings were the first of their kind structures without any center support. So they basically used arch technology to create a freestanding space with nothing in the way of the view. And they have a walkway, a raised gallery that goes around the circumference of the building 30 feet high so you can look down on this jungle.
Yeah, it's that cantilevered approach that they have used that now is... become quite popular.
Yeah, so these spiral staircases to go up there, and you're kind of wondering whether or not this, you know, 1880s steel is going to hold up. And they have the preservation isn't just for the plant collections, but also for the architecture.
Yeah, because I mean that would be amazing just to see that in itself too.
But just back to your point about some of the rarer plants of the collection. So going back to the Princess of Wales Conservatory, the Kew was the first botanical garden to successfully propagate the corpse flower, Titan arum, which we have locally here at Cal State Fullerton, and the Huntington has their own collection. And so they have like a dozen of these corpse flowers at different stages of flowering. And it starts off, when we were there, it's like a grow bag. It's like a huge grow bag that's maybe 3 foot square that this small tree was growing out of, and that was the life stage that of the plant that was on display. And it looks kind of like it's a single stem that comes up, and not that big of a canopy, maybe a 10-foot diameter ball canopy, but that dies back, and then from the root, the flower comes up. And again, these corpse flowers, they literally only flower for 24 to 36 hours, and then they're done. If you wait, for example, to get the LA Times story about the corpse flower flowering...
It's gone.
It's gone. And I did that at the Huntington this summer and got up there the next day, and I got a picture of an empty pot because it had already died and they got rid of it.
And the corpse flower, for those of you that don't know, to attract pollinators, it has a smell that's similar to something dying. So that makes it kind of unique.
Another interesting plant is an orchid. It's called Rothschild slipper orchid. It's from Borneo, so it's a tropical. And it's interesting. So it's kind of alternating stripes of magenta and white. But in the closer into the reproductive organs of the orchid flower, it has spots that look just like aphids. And so there's a wasp that lays its eggs in aphids. And so it is drawn to the Rothschild slipper orchid to come in and lay its eggs. Well, the spots are far enough in that basically it rubs up against the pollen, rubs up against the stamen. And so it's a very efficient way for a very specialized pollinator that favors and specializes in this particular orchid to spread the pollen from plant to plant.
What color is the flower?
The flower is kind of a, I would say, kind of a I don't know. It's kind of a
magenta.
Yeah, kind of a magenta, dark red.
Kind of maybe with some peachy tones in there too, yeah. As I look at that.
Yeah. And then the last one here that I thought was interesting is it's called Dutchman's Pipes. And this is a genre of plant that I'm spacing out on the genus right now. But it occurs on types of this plant exists. So it is a it's a vine plant, so it will grow up into the trees and create these rather large flowers that are speckled purple and white, and it almost looks like a calla lily with water dripping out of it, but that's, again, just the plant parts. And this one's a little more elaborate. And again, so it is, it's designed to attract the pollinators that that specialize in this plant. And so the floral chamber, as they go into it, there are hairs mm-hmm. that point inward. And so this particular wasp, as it goes in, it's easy getting in, but it ain't easy getting out.
Yeah.
And the they're not really barbs, but they are these hairs, but they're stiff hairs. And so mm-hmm. what happens is the insect gets imprisoned in the floral chamber for a day or two, and these hairs die back and then release it. Well, by this time, the wasp is completely covered
with the pollen,
and mm-hmm. they fly off to the next one. Again, they spend a lot of time in the next floral chamber introducing the pollen that they just collected from the previous plant. So it's Darwin, and you see this in the tropical plants, the mm-hmm. specialization of and the symbiotic relationship between the plants and the animals in terms of learning to depend on each other and only each other to... But just visually, these plants, I mean, they are, it's like you would were dropped down on a planet someplace, mm-hmm. you know, completely separate from Earth. It's unearthly, as how I would describe some of these flowers. I mean, the colors jump off of, you know, tropical plant communities typically are mostly green, right? But then right. when they have the color... You know, whether it's the orchid or the Dutchman's pipes, the plants just pop. They just absolutely pop. And so, I mean, people, I think one of the joys for gardeners to visit botanic gardens is it puts you in the moment, right? So you can't, and I think that's true with travel too, is, you know, when you're really just in the moment, you're not thinking about the issues of the day of mm-hmm. getting there or mm-hmm. what's coming up and worrying about how you're going to get to from point A to point B or something else that's going on with your family. It just forces you kind of this raw natural beauty forces you to just stop and enjoy what's in front of you. And it's just such a relaxing, almost euphoric feeling that I get when I get into some of these exotic flower displays.
Well, and I think the other point is too that by seeing this, that people don't realize is it's important that we as humans allow all species to stay extant, and that things get so specialized in a lot of specialized environment. When one thing goes extinct, it begins to create a domino effect. And I think we're seeing that in the garden here. And that's an important aspect of looking at these gardens and looking at what they're preserving and just making us aware of the uniqueness of that planet that we live on, from whether it be the tropics area to right here in our own environment here in Orange County. So plants have always been a source of inspiration for artists. And throughout history, from Vincent van Gogh's sunflowers to Claude Monet's water lilies to the botanicals of Georgia O'Keeffe. And so I'm going to have you tell us a little bit about the inspirational art that's found around the queue. And I'll probably interrupt you partway through because we do have to do our mid-show break here coming up in a few minutes. So go ahead.
Sounds good, Bill. Thanks. Just like the science and the conservation, queue really does stand at the kind of the apex here of botanical gardens in the world in terms of incorporating art, both permanent exhibits as well as rotating exhibits. The Kew Royal Botanical Gardens is the only botanical garden with a world-class art museum that's based on botany.
Mm.
And so it is in itself just a phenomenal art gallery. And again, they crammed a lot in there. And They used a building that's probably undersized, and so it's pretty jam-packed going in there. It was hard for me to even want to go in there just because there's so much to see in the plant world and the plant collections.
Right.
Which I guess I'd make a point here. With Q especially, it's like going trying to get on every ride in Disneyland. It's just not going to happen, right? So you have to pick, you know, what's important to you today? What do you want to experience today? But the art gallery, I didn't go to. But looking at the descriptions online and the imagery, it just looks beautiful. Some of the other installations, the number one visiting spot at Kew Gardens is this immersive multi-sensory thing called The Hive.
Hmm.
And The Hive was originally intended to be a six-month installation. It was originally at a conference in Italy, and it was transported back to England for a six-month run. Well, it was so popular, it's now been there 15 years.
They kept it. And before we go on and talk a little bit more about The Hive, I have to tell you the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit kuci.org. You're listening to 88.9 KUCI Irvine. This is In the Garden, and we're talking about the Kew Royal Botanical Garden with Master Gardener Chris Bonner in our Garden of the World series. This is the first in the series, and we will hopefully do more. I'm sure we'll do more. So, Chris, you were telling us about The Hive, which is an installation that was so popular it became permanent. And what else to say about The Hive or other art installations?
So you've just left the Alpen and Rock Glass House, mm-hmm. and the Princess of Wales Conservatory with the desert and the succulent collection that they have there, and you're wandering down, and you come across this wisteria that has trunks on the wisteria that are over 12 inches in diameter, and
wow.
It creates this room, wisteria room, that's like you're in this, and again, it's like this incredible floral experience. You know, we were there with this cascading, purple plumes all around us, and you walk out of that and walk down the pathway, and on this little hill off to your left, you see this, and you're not sure what it is. It's like it's a structure, but it's like it's not solid. It's like a lattice work, and so it's kind of, it looks fuzzy, mm-hmm. even though it's in focus in your eyes, it kind of looks fuzzy. It's kind of cube shaped, but it's got a softness to it and a see-through to it. And as you get closer, you discover it's this grid of honeycombs, so hexagons, mm-hmm. all built together. And you walk into it, and the main floor is these hexagons of glass. And as you come in, you hear this buzzing sound.
Mm.
And it's like, what's the buzzing sound? Well, there's a sign there to tell you that they have beehives, all live beehives all over Kew, and they mic them up, such as you've done with me here today. They put microphones on them, and they have thousands of small speakers in this structure. So you experience what it would be like to be a humming bee inside of a hive.
Wow.
And it turns out bees make their noise in a perfect B flat tone. And so there's I think I've got that right, but it's a perfect pitch in nature. And so you've got this visual, like you're looking outside from inside the beehive, and now you're experiencing the sound of it. With the pandemic, they had to shut this down, but down below, looking up to this main stage, mm-hmm. they have these posts, and you, with these wooden sticks, you put in your mouth and clamp in your teeth to touch to this metal post, and you actually can hear through your bones. You actually, rather than through your
through
ears,
the vibration
through
of
the vibration,
sound.
You can actually feel the humming of the bees as they get into it. And if you're lucky enough to come back at dusk into the evening, and it does stay open during the summer months, they've got about 5,000 LED lights. So there's a whole light aspect to it, to bring in a whole different visual as you get into low light situations. So that's just, and again, it's just, it's one of these things where you can get into the science and really appreciate, and there's a lot of on-site documentation about the importance of bees and native bees in maintaining plants and pollination and everything else. But you can just enjoy it as an experience. You can enjoy it as art, or you can enjoy it as science. It's kind of like a...
All the way, and if you're a kid, you'd love to hear those
and
vibrations.
And again, the kids, they are just, the kids just flock to this.
I can imagine. So if you've got a family, there's something that would be attractive for a kid or an adult of all ages.
Another really cool art installation are these giant gnomes. And I'm not a garden gnome kind of a guy, right? Some gardeners get into that and it's like, yeah, it's a little too much for me. I don't really get into garden gnomes. But this is a garden gnome that's these large wooden gnomes that are maybe 15 feet tall and 50 feet long.
Oh, wow.
And so Q, when it was originally created in the 1700s and early 1800s, they didn't just plant trees. They planted specimens, large trees with, think, 8-foot boxes on a horse-drawn lowboy carriage that... they planted a tree that might have been 50 feet tall when it started. And so now these trees, the diameters of these, and every species of hardwood tree and conifer you can imagine, the diameters of some of these trunks can be, you know, 6, 8, 10 feet diameter trees. So they're not as tall as our redwoods, but still there's a lot of plants in the 150, a lot of trees in the 150 to 200 foot range. One of the things that's happened, and they really couldn't explain it to me, my guide couldn't explain if this was a climate change thing or just the fact that these trees were getting so tall, they have lost a number of these giant trees to lightning strikes in the last 15 years. And they've left some of them in place, right, because that becomes habitat for woodpeckers and other types of avian species. But some of them, they've taken the fallen wood and they have reused it. And so these gnomes aren't just giant wooden gnomes. This is artistic reuse of these magnificent 200-year-old trees from Kew Gardens that were planted in the 1700s.
Oh, that's a great story.
It's whimsical, right? I mean, gnomes are kind of whimsical. There's a whimsy aspect to it. We missed an exhibition. It was called The Edible Table. And it was the same thing, the same wood turned into this long table, you know, with 6-inch planks for the tabletops. But it was built over planters. So it's planter boxes. You can't tell they're planter boxes. But growing up through what appears to be a pot sitting on the table that actually has a big planter underneath it. And it has all the plants that you would find for English tea.
Oh.
So strawberries and tea and lavender and camille and so basically all the plants that go to contribute to high tea in London.
So a tea garden, if you will.
It's a tea garden done as a table setting, with as though these were small ceramic pots sitting on a table that were spouting these beautiful, live, large specimens of the different plants. So just kind of really kind of a cool thing.
How fun. So what are the takeaways you learned from the Kew that you could apply to your own garden in Orange County?
I think I mentioned this, but I think the fact that flowers and plants have peak times, and you know, Monty Don has a joke, you know, he always asks, you know, what's the best time to go visit this garden?
Yeah.
And his answer, with the answer he always got was 2 weeks before you got here or 2 weeks after you're going to leave.
So I'm not going to ask you that question then.
But the point is that they have peak times, and so you have to have plant diversity so that there's something going on an ongoing basis. And so that's really what I brought back to my garden in Orange County is, you know, I've got kind of classic suburban plants, right? So I've got crepe myrtles that have just done their color with the leaves.
Yeah.
My azaleas are coming on. During the winter months, I had Kalanchoe planted in my succulent pots to add little splashes of color.
Okay.
Moving in the spring, you know, so the idea of each season, there's something going on, and I don't rely on one plant. And it was funny, I didn't really appreciate that until after the queue, and it's like, oh, I didn't do such a bad job as a master gardener here in terms of having kind of a rotation of color. So I would say the having some diversity so that there's always something colorful, not necessarily flowers, but also leaves happening each season.
Yeah, oh, fantastic. So let's talk about actually visiting. We'll get to the nuts and bolts of a visit. So what are the logistics of visiting the Kew from London? How would you go about getting there?
So you're in London, and you can get there by car, or you can get there by train. Most okay. people choose to go by train, right? So in London proper, it's called the Tube. It's an underground subway system. But as it gets out of the older part of London, it comes, the Tube becomes, I don't know exactly if they still call it the Tube or not, but it becomes a like BART or something.
It comes above ground, right.
It comes above ground. And so it's a one transfer 45-minute rail ride. We stayed pretty close to Big Ben in our hotel. And so we got lost, and the people in England are so helpful. They can see that you're lost, and it's like, okay. Uh-oh, we missed our transfer, and uh-huh. it's like, uh-oh, and it's cool. Google Maps works on the Tube.
Oh.
And so it tells you what platform to stand on. It tells you how many minutes for the next train's going to come, and then when you get on the train, a little train icon moves along, and it shows you the names of the stations coming up, and Q has its own station.
Oh, that's convenient.
So
wow.
You get off on Q, there's a little retail area there, and it's about a 10-minute walk from there. And so you can take a cab or an Uber type of a thing. If you had rented a car, if you're a brave soul who can get used to driving on the other side of the road, they do have a car park, as they call it, a parking okay. lot, so you can drive there and park. So, but it's an easy 45-minute journey from the center of London by train out to out there. There are no lockers or baggage storage facilities at Kew.
Okay, good to
and
know.
So just think about that. So you really want to go a little on the light side in terms of the possessions that you're bringing with you in terms of how you plan this. So would this make a good... the other thing, which can be a little off-putting, is Kew is located under the flight path for Heathrow.
Oh.
Heathrow is not that far away. And so there's this one really cool thing called the Treetop Walkway, which is a steel circular walkway that's about 5 or 6 stories up that walks among these giant ancient trees, which is really cool with glimpses of the glass houses, but then every 5 minutes you get a jet flying overhead.
Yeah, so you can kind of high-five the jets.
So you just have to kind of yeah. be aware of the discontinuity of these, mm-hmm. of this little sound thing that happens as it goes there.
Mm-hmm. How many days, could you do the queue in a day, or would you devote 2 days to properly visit?
I've only been there once, and huh. I will definitely go back there again. And again, I would... They have, they don't have tours per se, but there are a number of companies that offer tours, paid tours.
I see.
And so we did engage a private tour. There are also group tours. And so you can go on to, TripAdvisor or Travelocity or something, and you mm-hmm. can find these. We used another company that specializes in small group tours and personal and private tours.
Okay.
And so... for my first tour, what I have found when traveling is I don't see using tour guides as a luxury. I see it as a way to get a lot more out of a visit where you're limited on time. Because what the tour guides will do is they know exactly...
They know what's there.
They know what's there, yeah. and they know how to get around. They know where the bathrooms are. And really, you can get a lot more out of your day. And so... He said, he wanted to know what I was interested in. I said, I really want to see it all, but, I've got 2 or 3 hours here, so let's give me what you find people react to in the highlights. And so I would go with a private guide, but there were parts of Kew we didn't even get to. We didn't get to the Japanese garden. Mm-hmm. I've been to lots of Japanese gardens all the way around. The one there is kind of interesting, the pagoda, which is one of the 3 great buildings of Kew Gardens.
Mm.
It's a 15-story pagoda that during World War II, they jackhammered out the floors, and they used it to test the aerodynamics of bombs for World War II for Great Britain.
Oh, wow.
To be able to improve the aerodynamics of bomb dropping without it being seen as a military installation. And so this was a secret. Q was closed for the war, in part because they were actually using the Q pagoda to refine the accuracy of the bombs that were being dropped to win the Great War.
Yeah, what any place like that, it's just got such great stories, which is one of the other fun things about visiting a place like Kew. So hours of operations, do you recommend reservations?
So you buy tickets ahead of time. You want to buy tickets ahead of time, especially in the summer. And again, I don't know that they ever sell out. Weekends are going to be most busy, so it's going to be important. Mm-hmm. Their website is very good. It's easy to buy tickets. Tickets are $28 US. I'm not sure what they are in Euro.
Yeah, that's not bad.
No, it's not bad. It opens at 10 o'clock daily every day, except maybe major holidays. And they close at 4, 5, or 6 o'clock, depending on the season, right? Because when it gets dark and cold...
Yeah, you don't want to be there.
Yeah, and it's wet a lot of the time in England. I think it's... Even days... It seemed to rain every day, but it doesn't get in the way of anything. And so the rain doesn't really stop you from seeing a place from Kew.
So what are the food or restaurant availabilities within Kew?
There are a number of restaurants and food options, all the way from fast food and pub food, all the way to high-end sit-down. We ate at a kind of a cafeteria called the Terrace Cafe. Mm-hmm. They were trying to make it all vegan something. It was pretty tasteless, I have to say. But looking on the website, and it was a little tired. It was like done maybe in the 80s. But I can see the photographs, they've completely redone the menu and the building. And so it's probably a lot better. And again, when you go to a place like this, you're not going to go for fine dining. You just want some food. So there's lots of easy ways to get food within Kew Gardens or that little area just outside the tube station, too.
And you may also, too, want a garden tea if it's in the summer months, which would be fun.
They offer a British tea in the orangery. And so orangeries existed before they invented greenhouses. Uh-huh. So it's a building with lots of windows that they grew citrus.
Yeah.
And so the orangery is also a restaurant right now.
Okay, well, that's good to know. So plenty to eat right in there. And about how much walking is involved on a typical visit? That's a hard question.
It's to go from the Victoria's entry to the farthest place, it's about 25 minutes one way. So it'd be about an hour round trip to the furthest place, the far end of the Arboretum. Basically, it's you probably will do 2 hours before you start to get a little tired. Then it's a good time to find a place to sit down. Maybe have a cool beverage. It does get warm and humid in the summer there. So finding a place to sit down and get hydrated and get some caloric intake to get your energy back up. So, I would say, 2 hours. So you're probably going to walk 4, 5, or 6 miles.
Okay, that's not too bad. And if you space that out, that's good. And I imagine that most of the pathways would be wheelchair accessible?
It's completely wheelchair accessible. It's almost all flat except what they've built up. And so again, going from kind of using the tent poles, if you will, the glass houses, the Palm House, the Tempered House, Princess of Wales, the Alpine House, Water Lily House, if you just put those on a map and just meandered from one to the other, you're going to see lots of beautiful gardens in between. Okay. And you could do that in a couple of hours, just depending on how much time you want to spend in each one of those.
Okay, that's not too bad. Again, that's very doable. Do they have any kind of tramway tours at all?
They do not. They have a tram that's basically transportation.
Okay.
So they don't. It's not like a...
So it might take you to the car park and back.
It's going to do a loop.
Oh, I see.
And again, it seemed to be... wasn't a lot of them, right? It wasn't like a big bus kind of a thing. It was more like a large golf cart.
Okay.
So I'm mobile, I'm ambulatory, so I wasn't really looking at that and even thinking about how my wheelchair-bound friends might handle it. But I did see people pushing wheelchairs, and it didn't seem to be...
Not a problem.
It wasn't like they had a beefy guy pushing the wheelchair. It seemed like, mom and dad and grandma, right?
Okay, that works. So if I had just a limited time to visit, what are the must-see areas for an Orange County gardener?
I would stick to the glass houses. I would just start there. And again, you're going to see, and they've replanted some of the things. I mean, my background is in natural resources, so I was drawn to the grass garden, which visually is not exciting, but I really want to see that one. They have a thing called the Great Broad Walk. Broad Walk, I called it, and you corrected me. No, it's the Broad Walk.
Okay.
And it's it's flowering Britain, and they have these cutouts, these scallops, these semicircles that sequentially flower. I mean, that's just, if you're there in the flowering season, that's great. If you're there for roses, that's great. But you go to the glass houses, and again, these are semi-tropical, tropical plants that they're growing in this, you know, man-made environment. The water lily house, you don't see a lily pond like this with 10-foot lilies.
And oh, wow.
Yeah.
And I would also imagine the orchids where they have those would be quite beautiful.
The orchids were in the Princess of Wales Conservancy. There was quite a few orchids there, yeah.
Yeah, and that would be fun to see those. So definitely do the glass houses. And tell us a little bit about special events that take place at the Kew throughout the year, because that might help someone plan their own visit to where they want to go.
Well, a number of people try to make their trip, their plant people, they might do a trip to London to visit the Chelsea Flower Show.
Okay.
I was there and I couldn't get tickets.
Oh.
So you have to buy tickets the previous fall if you're just going to buy them yourself. Otherwise, the tour guide snapped them up and now you have to get a ticket by buying a tour. And that's how Master Gardeners in 2016 went to the Chelsea Flower Show, including our friend Sally Richards, right? So they went as part of a tour. So a lot of people, they'll come for Chelsea and they'll also take a visit over to Kew at the same time. But they have concerts, they have art shows, they've got stuff going on year round, really. And again, more in the warmer months than the cool months, you know, again, so, but they have art shows happening. So literally every month of the year, there's something on. So I would just say, check with the website. Plan your trip around whatever else, other reasons you're going to England or to the UK, and then just see what's there and then kind of micro plan your trip based on whether or not it's something that you want to see.
Yeah, and so you can get that going. And I would imagine too, even if you were at the Kew at the Christmas season, I'm sure they have some kind of a holiday
London
display.
London does Christmas. A friend of ours just got back. London does Christmas like nobody's business. It was like, oh, they really do Christmas. And I imagine the Kew does the same thing. They do wine and food events in the warm months outside. You know, they have wine and food festivals.
Okay.
They have music festivals. They have symphonic music. So really, almost anybody's taste. I don't think they do country and western, but they probably do a lot of other.
Yeah, I would imagine.
They do jazz, I know. So lots and lots of special events.
And as we close up our show here, is there anything more to add about visiting the Kew? Anything that you can bring back? In fact, can you buy plant cuttings to propagate here?
The Kew is one of the nicest nurseries. And so the gift shop is off the charts. So ladies, you will love the Kew gift shop just as a gift shop. I mean, it's about three times bigger than the average botanical garden. I mean, if you've been to the one at the Huntington, it's at least twice as big as the gift shop at the Huntington. It's humongous. And then it has a decent nursery attached to it that they sell the plants that are grown and propagated at the Kew, intended for people that live in the neighborhood. So this basically is a neighborhood nursery.
Oh,
but
that's cool.
I mean, I know some of the local garden clubs, they include tours of nurseries, right? Because as plantaholics, right, we just love this, to visit nurseries, even if we're not going to buy anything. And so absolutely, you will spend time at the nursery at the Kew.
Okay, and so for travelers that have a suitcase, I imagine a cutting or a packet of seeds could probably be brought home.
So if you bring a cutting, you will have to violate federal law to bring that cutting
home.
Okay,
I can't bring the
cutting. No live plant material, no soil whatsoever because of potential hitchhikers. You can bring seeds.
Yeah.
Absolutely, you can bring seeds. And so do people sneak in other stuff? Yes, and that's...
Well, we shouldn't, and we have to go by federal law, especially as natural gardeners or master gardeners, because that's one of the ways that critters have gotten into Southern California.
The conservatory at the Huntington just had to be opening on Valentine's Day after being closed for a year because someone introduced an exotic snail from Southeast Asia that isn't in the outside of the Huntington right now. So they had to shut it down and get it cleansed to the point where there weren't any more. So again, it's, you don't bring back live stuff.
Yeah, so seeds, and and it sounds like they have an awesome seed collection, and I'm sure books would be another good thing for an Orange County gardener to bring back with them.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, this has been a treat, and I know that this is the first of what we hope are many shows to highlight these gardens around the world, and we'll do both far, and we'll do some that you don't have to get on an airplane to go see, which will be a nice part of our series here. And I want to remind you that the opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of the station, of the university, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this show, visit KUCI.org. You're listening to FM 88.9 KUCI in Irvine. This is In the Garden, and we've been talking about the Kew Royal Botanical Garden with Master Gardener Chris Bonner. Thank you, Chris, for joining us today. Humans have been enclosing spaces to create gardens for at least the last 10,000 years, and it's been a delight learning about the Kew and what we can bring back from the Kew right here to Southern California. And stay tuned, because we will be doing other gardens in the first of this series.